Thank you again for a very wonderful, wonderful thing. Thanks very much. As many of you know, I'm going to be away next Sunday with Rick Maston and the congregation at the Unitarian Universalist Church, Monterey Peninsula in Carmel, California, to do a service centered around the book that he and I got out last fall. Looking forward to that, of course. And our worship associates have planned what I know will be a very good service next Sunday. I hope you'll attend and come give them your support. I know two people you've already seen here this morning, Laurie and Mike, are involved with that, as well various others. So please come and be supportive of them and take part in the service they have prepared for you. So since I will not be here, and I thought about this sometime back when I saw what the schedule was for when I would need to take a quick trip out west, I thought, well, I'd still like to do a Martin Luther King Day, a Martin Luther King sermon. So I decided, well, we can always just do it a week early, which is what this service is about today. And I thought, well, actually, Dr. King's birthday is day after tomorrow, on Tuesday the 15th, so today we are closer to his birthday than if we were doing it on the so-called official Sunday anyhow. Well, I'm going to open up then with a passage from a book that I believe I introduced here a couple of years ago, a book called Middle Church. It's by Bob Edgar. He is the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches. He's a former congressman from Pennsylvania, and he's an ordained elder in the United Methodist Church. And the book's subtitle is called Reclaiming the Moral Values of the Faithful Majority from the Religious Right. And in this book's introduction, Edgar writes about seeing Dr. King at a peace rally for clergy and lay leaders in Washington, D.C., which had been called to express opposition to the Vietnam War. It was held in early February of 1968. Here's how Mr. Edgar describes the occasion. It was a clear day in Washington, bitterly cold, but brilliantly sunny. As I leaned over the balcony rail from the upper level of the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, the preacher we had come to hear walked up the center aisle. It was one of those profound experiences that imprints itself on one's memory in the form of general feelings rather than specifics. I cannot recall the words, only that his voice seemed to fill every space in the church, that he was earnest, afraid, and that he was able to challenge America's moral failings without seeming judgmental or alienating. For him, the Gospels formed a seamless tapestry with current events, and he was unafraid to speak in both terms of right and wrong. The preacher in the pulpit on that cold but clear February day in 1968 was a 39-year-old Georgia-raised Baptist named Martin Luther King, Jr. As I read Bob Edgar's book, shortly after it first came out, I found myself being drawn back to that particular passage. The reason being that I was in that same New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, also leaning over the balcony at the same event that Mr. Edgar attended. Nearly 40 years later, I was able to catch up to Mr. Edgar at a book signing he did and speak with him about how we had each shared the same experience at a much earlier stage in each of our lives. I was a seminarian at the time. And he was exactly right when he said it was one of those profound experiences that imprints itself on one's memory. Indeed, it was. And for me, it continues to be. And it was an experience made all the more profound for me and for all who were there, I am quite sure, in that 2 months later, Dr. King was murdered, and the turmoil and the unrest of those days took an even deeper and more troubling turn. I know there are any number of ways that one can go with working on a sermon on the life and legacy of Dr. King, at the time that we honor his life and memory. And in thinking over that, I decided this year I wanted to take my King Day Sunday reflections in a mainly personal direction. drawing on Bob Edgar's words about how the profound experience of having seen and heard the man imprints itself on one's memory. Let's say it certainly does 40 years later for me. But I'm not just, in fact, I'm not even primarily going to speak of the event at which Mr. Edgar and I happened to be present, inspiring and moving as it was. What I'd like to do now is share a personal perspective. A perspective, as I say, that spans over 40 years now. As to how the life and example of Martin Luther King shaped the consciousness and shaped the ministries of those of my generation who came of our ministerial age at the time when Dr. King's ministry was at its height. I speak primarily of those of us who were preparing for the ministry in sort of the moderate to liberal American Protestant tradition, while knowing quite well that Dr. King's influence went far beyond that point. Well, I said this would be personal, so that's the point from which I will launch for it. The faith in which I was raised, and which I know I have spoken about here on numerous occasions, was an almost entirely personalistic kind of one. That is to say, the goal of faith was personal salvation, being personally reconciled to God by the acceptance of Jesus Christ as one's personal Savior. And by the same token, living a religious life was also understood as a primarily personal endeavor. It meant living a life of virtue and goodness, so that your very life would be a witness for Jesus, which then would in turn lead others to accept him so they too could be saved. And sure, you were going to do things that were less than good and less than virtuous, but you could seek God's forgiveness and then just get on with it. And so personal belief and personal piety were the hallmarks of the religion that was mine up through towards pretty close to the end of my teenage years. Well, it kind of stands to, or goes without saying, that the content of my faith has changed markedly since those days. And yet I still take very seriously, and I take very joyfully as well, the personal dimension to religion and spirituality. For cultivating a religious and a spiritual life, whatever its content might be, really is about finding some kind of personal transformation. And if I may say so, it's about finding some kind of personal salvation, even for liberals, even for Unitarian Universalists. Well, I can't remember exactly when it was, probably about the time I entered high school, that I first began to hear the name of Martin Luther King. And then I would hear him sometimes referred to as Reverend King. And somewhere in there, I heard that he was a Baptist minister. And this was very confusing. What did leading a civil rights march or demonstrations have to do with being a minister? And a Baptist at that. I knew who a Baptist minister was, the minister of my hometown church, a very wonderful and dear man. But I certainly couldn't see him out leading demonstrations and peace rallies and things such as this. And I wondered what that was about. Because indeed, the very first things I ever heard said about Dr. King were, for the most part, quite negative ones. And I don't mean just the blatantly racist stuff about him being an uppity you-know-what, although I heard that one plenty enough, but also that he was somehow besmirching the Christian faith by using it as the cornerstone and underpinning of his civil rights work. And all that Baptist minister stuff was probably just a front to hide the fact that he was really a communist, or at least a communist sympathizer. I wasn't quite sure what to make of all such talk myself. You know, you're in high school, you're still kind of forming your worldview, trying to figure some things out, and I'm hearing this, I'm seeing Dr. King on television, hearing about it on the radio, and then hearing this kind of negative talk in the culture in which I was living at that time. And when I graduated from high school then, which was just a few months before he gave his 1963 I Have a Dream speech in Washington, I felt mostly ambivalent about him. as I went off to college with my plans, even then, to be a minister. Those plans, more specifically, were to attend a Baptist seminary somewhere in the South and then come back to West Virginia and get back to the business of saving souls. That was the career track I was on when I entered Marshall University, fall of 1963, a few weeks after King's I Have a Dream speech. Well, jump about 5 years later, I was attending the peace gathering that Bob Edgar writes about. I was attending a very religiously liberal seminary in upstate New York and seriously working my whole ideas and understandings of what ministry and the religious life was all about. So what in heaven's name happened to me? Well, to hear some of the very dear folk in my hometown church tell about it, maybe the communists had gotten to me too. What really happened was, beginning somewhere towards the mid to latter part of my college experience and continuing on through my seminary days, was my discovery of what was and is called the social gospel. This is the idea that personal transformation and the transformation of one's larger society and world are all a part of the same process. And that part of being a person of faith, whatever one's faith may be, part of being a person of faith means taking the values of your faith and using those values and beliefs to confront such social evils as racism and poverty and violence and injustices of many kinds, and seeking to bring greater measures of love and compassion, justice and peace to the world in which we find ourselves and to which we are called to bring those values. And to my seminary classmates and to me in the latter part of the 1960s, it was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King who embodied that kind of ministry, who embodied what it meant to live out this social gospel and be a person of faith in the world. I don't think any of us saw ourselves as the next Dr. King. I know I didn't. But we were inspired by his example of putting faith into action in an attempt to transform society. One thing I will never forget, the night Dr. King was killed, were the looks on the often teary faces of my African-American classmates at our seminary, some of whom knew him personally. And neither will I ever forget the looks on the faces of the many persons of color in the Rochester, New York area who attended the memorial service for Dr. King that was held in our seminary chapel a day or two later. All I knew was that something had been taken from them which my white experience would never completely allow me to completely grasp. Theirs was a loss that I would never completely and fully know. But I do know that practically all of us on that campus, clear across racial lines, had lost a mentor. We had lost someone who had shown us a thing or two about public social justice ministry in its best sense. We had lost someone who, with his acknowledged personal flaws, had shown what it meant as a person of faith to confront the terrible failings of one society while also calling that same society to its highest ideals and principles. Someone whose aspiration was that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed, as he put it in his best known speech and sermon. The theology, or the understanding of God behind that social gospel I referred to a few moments ago, to which I'm going to return for just a minute or two here, the theology behind that was not of a Santa Claus-like supreme being who is keeping some kind of a checklist of our personal rights and wrongs, knows when you've been good and bad and all that stuff, but rather a force or presence or power at work in human history, moving within the human story, and calling on human beings, in the words of the Hebrew prophets, to do justice and love mercy, and to let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. That's Micah and Isaiah. Or Micah and Amos. still remember my biblical studies here. And I find it interesting that most of the sound clips of the I Have a Dream speech, which will be shown about this time next week, many of those sound clips only come in on the last few lines, which are by themselves very uplifting, very inspiring. But what often goes unheard are all the biblical cadences that lead up to that conclusion, where in the voice and the style he had heard his own father use in the pulpit of Atlanta's Ebenezer Baptist Church, Dr. King spoke of how every valley shall be exalted and every mountain made low. The rough places plain and the crooked places straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. What he was doing was taking very ancient language from the book of Isaiah and recasting it as a metaphor or as a symbol for the world he envisioned, for what he said were all of God's people, which was to say the whole human race. He took then the traditional language of faith beyond the realm of personal piety and made it an instrument of social transformation. And to see someone do that in the way that Dr. King could do while preparing for the ministry yourself, well, they say, to put it in a very understated way, that was indeed very inspiring. I'm going to briefly throw in one other bit of historical perspective here. The rise of the religious right in this country was in good measure, not entirely, but it was in good measure, a reaction or a backlash against the ascent of the social gospel in mainline Protestantism and to a lesser degree the ascent of liberation theology in Catholicism. And just as the Protestant fundamentalism that first gained strength in this country in the late 19th century was a largely a reaction against and a fear of the ascent of a modern scientific age, the religious right, as it came into being and gained strength in the 1980s and 1990s, was really in large measure a protest against those social gospel advocates of the 60s and the 70s. Yes, the agenda of the religious right was also to influence and is also to influence public policy, as is the case with social gospel advocates. But for the religious right, and given my own background, this does not surprise me, that agenda centers around mostly, as you'll notice, exclusively personal belief issues, like abortion or homosexuality, evolution, and the like. Now that whole movement is now showing some signs of wear and tear. But that's another topic for another day. Right now, I want to get back on the main rail. Over the years then, since the days that I spoke about a few minutes ago, over the years, I've had my own kind of internal wrestlings and arguments with Dr. King's theology, even as I continue to be guided and inspired by his example. It was those wrestlings, in fact, that in time kind of scooted me over from the liberal Christianity I had embraced by the time I got to seminary to the more humanistic perspectives of Unitarian Universalism. That's how I got here. People sometimes ask me how I made it from being an evangelical Baptist to a UU. Really, the biggest jump was getting from the right wing to the left wing of Protestant Christianity. From there was a kind of walk on over to Unitarian Universalism. But there's one particular line to which Dr. King himself often returned that continues to be one of my fixed stars. One of his oft-used phrases was to say, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." And that one he didn't get from the Bible. He got that one instead from a Unitarian minister who had preceded him by about a full century. That was the Reverend Theodore Parker. Parker was a renegade Unitarian for his day, both in his theology and his activism as a fiery abolitionist. Around the middle of the 19th century, he had a huge following at his Unitarian church in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, much to the consternation of the more establishment Boston Unitarians of his day. Parker was kind of a combination Christian humanist who anticipated the coming of the social gospel by several decades. And Dr. King felt something of a spiritual tie to Parker, and he freely invoked his words. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. The language, of course, is metaphorical. You can't look up at the sky on a clear night and see a moral arc. Well, maybe you've got a pretty good imagination. You can. But it's a powerful metaphor. As powerful as those ancient words from Isaiah. And its power lies in the challenge it offers to persons of faith and to persons of many faiths. How are you using the strength of your convictions to move that moral arc a little further, just a little further, in the direction of a more just world? This was the challenge Dr. King put before his listeners, as well as before the nation of which he was a citizen. And this is the challenge he has left for us, to keep moving that moral arc a few more degrees at least in the proper direction. Well, we wrapped up a pretty remarkable election season here this past week in this state of ours. I figured to ignore that today would be like ignoring probably the proverbial 800-pound gorilla in the parlor. Just a few thoughts, which I hope do relate to what I've already said. Some of us, as Wednesday morning came around, were pleased. Some of us were stunned. Some of us disappointed. Most of us wondering where it all goes from here. Like many of you, I had my preferred candidate for whom I voted. I hope all of you voted anyway. But beyond my preference, which hasn't changed, what I will continue to keep looking for as this process plays itself out from now to November is the candidate, or actually the candidates for any number of public offices that will be before us, those candidates whom I feel best possess the abilities, the qualities, the ideals, and the values that will move Theodore Parker's and Martin Luther King's moral arc, at least, as I say, a few more degrees in the direction it so desperately needs to go. And even as I say that, however, I do so with the awareness and the understanding that the path and movement of that moral arc bending towards justice does not fully depend or rely upon the actions of elected officials, whatever office they may hold. And with all due respect and great admiration for my friends who hold public office, I have to say thank God for that. Indeed, when I think of some of the people who have moved that moral arc along, people like Martin Luther King or William Sloan Cotton, Mahatma Gandhi, Archbishop Oscar Romero, going back a bit further, Dorothy Dix, Susan B. Anthony, Sojourner Truth, the list can go on. I'm aware that none of these people ever held an elected public office. Their strength came and their influence came from the strength of their personalities, from their moral energy, and from their being on the right side of history as they sought to advance what our Second Unitarian Universalist principle calls justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And I think of another saying or slogan too. I know it's just a slogan, but I grant a certain credence to that 1960s adage about how if the people will lead, the leaders will follow. It was Dr. King's inspired leadership in the civil rights movement, which then caused his hearers to become leaders themselves by being a part of a movement that eventually caused the United States Congress and President Lyndon Johnson to enact the far-reaching civil rights legislation ever seen to that point. The people led, and the leaders followed. And that's part of our calling as persons of a liberal religious faith, to be the people who will lead so that the leaders will, in time, have to follow. And that call is part of the continuing legacy of Martin Luther King. Dr. King called his hearers to run a race, more a persistent and ongoing marathon, more like it. And that race or that marathon goes on. It is one we are called to take part in as we bring our values, hopes, dreams, and convictions, to a world that both blesses us deeply and confounds and wounds us as well, and a world that is worthy of our love, worthy of our efforts. While Dr. King's race to justice was tragically and horribly cut short, his was certainly not a race that was run in vain. Neither must ours be. Together we will continue to make the words of his dream flesh. Together we will move the moral arc along as it further bends towards justice.